When I was in grade school, I knew from how the taste of the pomegranates would bring you to tears, from the way the summer sun turned our afros blood orange red, and from how giddy my father would get whenever he talked about Dodger Stadium, White Zinfandel, and the latest green flash sunset he'd seen from the summit of Mount Wilson that California was a special place. And if you think about it, pretty much everything that made the 20th century bearable was invented in a California garage: the Apple computer, the boogie board, and gangster rap. Bon Bon, the sellout. Hello, I'm Kennedy Weibel.
And I'm Rebecca Capone.
And this is Reading Pop Classics, a podcast dedicated to modern popular books, pieces of literature that had a cultural impact either currently or in the recent past. Today, we're discussing Paul Beatty's 2015 novel, The Sellout. The Sellout follows an urban farmer who, over the course of the novel, revives both slavery and segregation in a fictional Los Angeles neighborhood called Dickens. The Sellout won the 2015 National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction and the 2016 Man Booker Prize. Beatty was the first American to ever win the Man Booker Prize, which became open to all English language novels in 2014. All right, Rebecca, start us off. Does The Sellout pass the Bechdel test?
It does pass the Bechdel test. I was kind of surprised to come across that conversation as I was reading it, really just because most of the conversations take place between our main character, so Bon Bon or me, or the sellout, depending on who's defining him, who's calling him by name. But it does in fact pass the Bechdel test due to a conversation between Laura Jane. So Laura Jane is an actress and part-time submissive who is hired by Bon Bon, to be the one white person on his segregated bus to move Hominy Jenkins, to force Hominy Jenkins to move out of his seat. And the conversation takes place between Laura Jane and Marpessa, Bon Bon's childhood girlfriend.
I think that's the only one, though, right?
It's the only, yes, it is. It's the only conversation between two women. There are women in the novel. Marpessa, Charisma is the middle school principal, but the two of them don't have conversations amongst themselves. Most other conversations, again, are between Bon Bon.
Condoleezza Rice is also in this
Oh,
book, I
Condoleezza
should
Rice
point
is also
out.
in this book. Yes, she is
Yeah.
also another female character in this book. But yes, they do not have conversations with other women, or really with anybody kind of besides Bon Bon.
Which leads us into this is a book where our black narrator and main character both has a slave and resegregates his town. So I think to say that the book tackles racial issues is almost an understatement, like a hilarious understatement. Like it comes at them pretty head on.
It does. I mean, I feel like nothing is safe, and if from nothing is safe from satire, in this book, which I think is something that which I think is a strength of the book. I honestly I cannot remember now if this was a conversation maybe you and I were having prior to recording our last podcast, or if we did touch on it in the podcast and we announced that we'd be doing the sellout as our next read. But I remember you calling the book, you've read the book before, and this was my first read. And I remember you referring to the book as audacious,
Yeah.
which is maybe the truest thing I've ever heard. And this book is very unapologetic with like it's kind of screaming satire, and I like that. I think that's a real strength of the book to come at something that's such a prickly topic, maybe for lack of a better way of saying it.
It feels a little bit like if the book is making a statement, one of them is, I don't care if it's hard
It
to
needs
talk
to be
about.
talked about because again, it is something that
Yeah.
affects it is something that affects everybody.
Like the book is saying, I don't care if it's hard to talk about, and I'm going to go even further and make it even harder to talk about by the very presentation of this book. Let me make this more uncomfortable and more difficult before you ever get comfortable, before you ever start to settle into thinking that it's an easy conversation or that it's something you can step around. Like, let me really turn the volume up on this is a difficult conversation. That's a little bit what the stance and the tone and the choice just to have a black guy resegregating a town as the premise of the novel seems to go after. I read this for the first time in 2016 or 2017. It was, I think I had it in paperback. So it was after the hardcover was out. And I wanted to, this is the problem I ran into. I really liked it. I thought it was a book unlike any book I'd ever read before. Not just in the way that it like talks about race, but just in general, like the tone of it, the humor in it, the writing style. I was just really excited by it. Like I just hadn't read something like this. And you and I read a lot. You read things that remind you of other stuff all the time. And there's nothing wrong with that, but you don't come across as many things that just remind you of nothing. Like just truly and wholly, like I just haven't ever experienced this before. It's the same with movies. I watch a lot of movies and I get really excited when one is just something I haven't come across. This hasn't ever, I just haven't seen anything like this. And it's hard for me to have not seen anything like this because I sit around watching movies all the time. And that's how I felt about this book. And I wanted to recommend it to everybody. And it was nearly impossible to do because you can't just go up to people and be like, you should read this book. It's about a black guy who brings back segregation. He also owns a slave. It's hilarious. Like, there's no way coming out of my white mouth that sounds like a recommendation you should take. Like, I can't go around telling people that at work.
Right, because
And that was
racism
my.
is if the concept that people often say that like race and racism is hard to talk about, this book might also come across as hard to talk about when you get down to like, here's what this book is about, from the sort of like bare bones of it. But I think that's I think that's purposeful, hard. Just because something is hard doesn't mean that we can't or shouldn't do it, right? Like we all have to do hard things all of the time, and talking about racism is one of them.
I almost feel like that situation I found myself in, though, is what a long tail part of the humor that the author put into the book. Like, let's see you go try to show everybody how enlightened you are because you read a black author's book. Let's see you go recommend this one. Go on, try. See how far you get. Go ahead, say the plot to your friends. Tell them how much you liked it. See how that sounds rolling off your tongue. I would refer to it as satire because that's the easiest way to describe it, is like it's satirical, I suppose. But a lot of what's in the book is real stuff, I guess. So calling it satire almost feels like a cheat, right? Like it's a
It does
it
a little bit, and I think maybe calling it a satire is again that way of making it less difficult to talk about.
Yeah, that's what it is. It feels like I'm cheating to call it a satire because a lot of the stuff that is in it is real and is not like the book takes cracks at things and like makes jokes about it. But cities like Dickens get wiped off the map all the time for real estate values, right? Or I think they reference it within this book, like the Hispanic community that was just obliterated so they could put Dodger Stadium in LA. Like the neighborhoods and the homes and the, legitimate town barriers and like real places that people of color or poor people or just marginalized communities in general live in, they get wiped off the map all the time. So when it happens in Dickens, it feels a little bit like a cheat to say it's satire. Like there's some part of New York where that's happening right now. Like there's some part of the town I live in that is currently just like gradually having a little condo creep block by block absorb a neighborhood that used to be there, that used to have a name, that used to have boundaries, and it's going to be gone. Like it's a real thing. And most of what's presented in this book is based on real things.
It is. And I think he uses, we talked about this with Eleanor Oliphant, is completely fine, this nihilistic humor. And I think that's what's, and I think that's something that he employs, and uses in here, maybe to see, maybe to highlight sort of how, maybe sort of to highlight how ridiculous some of this is, or how we can talk about how we can constantly, how ridiculous it is that we can constantly refer to the time after the civil rights movement as like post-racial America, and then it's like we still have this going on, and that is darkly that is darkly humorous, right? I mean, it's not, but that's what he's kind of like
Yeah.
using in this book.
And I think the fact that he, like the main driving plot of the book is that he is bringing back segregation is also a similar sort of thumb in the eye because we say that, like, you know, we ended segregation. I think it's the 14th Amendment.
Yeah.
We segregate things all the time. The schools are already segregated by zip code in a way, right? By reading ability, by these other things. We also segregate ourselves. Like people live in communities that are maybe representative of their race, maybe representative of their class or whatever they think their class is. When you drive around any given town, it is still segregated in a sense. And I think that's sort of one of the reasons he's chosen to like tackle that is like everyone gets all up in arms, like, how dare you bring back segregation? But did it ever really go away? We stopped saying it. We stopped officially doing it to like schools and buses and
Right,
diners.
we took off signs that specify, something is whites only, or this is where colored people can use the bathroom. This is a colored person's drinking fountain, to use the signs in the vernacular of the time. We've taken those things away, but like, yes, I mean, you still have underserved. We still have underserved schools that serve mostly children of color, right?
Yeah, we do it in, I'll pick television. There's white shows and there's black shows. There's a black channel. When a show like Friends is on, there just aren't black people on it. Like one per season or something like that.
Right, background characters here and there. They
Background characters.
here and there they bring in, a co-star or something. But no, that's a really good point. They do typically stay more white.
We kind of like, you know, there's like one token white character in a black sitcom. There's one token black character in a white sitcom, and so forth and so forth and so forth. And so then when someone comes along and starts officially doing it and everyone gets upset, I think that's what he's poking fun of a little bit. I think Bon Bon is doing it partially just to be a punk. Well, let's talk about our main character. Our main character is, we're calling him Bon Bon because that's the only
And the
sobriquet that he
sellout.
gets in the book other than me.
Turns out that's his last name.
But then it gives us this it gives us this history where he's like, I come from
Yeah,
the what is it, the
MEE.
Tennessee Mees out of Knoxville. MEE, but his father dropped one of the E's so that it was just me, which I think is one of the things that I reacted to so strongly in the book is it is just so literary. Like that's just for the fun of being able to do it in a book. Like just like the narrator is calling himself me. I'll take it one step further and say that that's an actual last name that he had, but it's not MEE. They dropped one E, so now it's still just me. So now we're back to this like literary device of the first person narrator
And
being
then the
named
title
me.
of the lawsuit is me versus the United States, which I like and I appreciate, because I think it makes us look at because I think that's like a
Yeah.
reflection of it, makes us look at our reaction to the things we're reading in this book.
So Bon Bon, which is what Marpessa, his on again, off again girlfriend throughout the book, the love of his life, that's how she refers to him. And then Foy Cheshire calls him the sellout.
I looked up something about the term the sellout in some of my reading and looking at videos and stuff to kind of prepare to talk about this book. So something that I came across. So according to law professor and author Randall L. Kennedy, the term sellout refers to Black people who knowingly or with gross negligence act against the interests of Blacks as a whole.
Yeah, in the 90s, that's what you called any band that you liked that had the nerve to become popular and make a little bit of money. Bon Bon doesn't want to join the dum dum donut intellectuals. He's sarcastic and dismissive of all of Foy's attempts at, what is it, with a capitalistic eye for looking out for Foy Cheshire himself, elevating Black people and celebrating Black excellence in any way that can kind of make Foy a buck, right?
Yeah, which is also selling out.
Which is also selling out.
Yeah.
Yes, which is hilarious. Also hilarious is so one of Foy's gambits He hosts television shows. He had a children's cartoon. He did lots of other things. But one of the things is he rewrites classic American literature from a black perspective.
I have a whole list. I have an entire
Yes.
list of every title that he
Okay, do
comes
you
up
want to
with.
go through them? Because I just
Because
one of the things that I loved about it
yes,
was that
because
they
it's one
kept
of
coming.
yes, because it's one of my it is it was one of my favorite parts of this book.
Because we keep going back to Foy and the Dum Dum Donut intellectuals, and I feel like each time we go back, we get another one that like hadn't come up before
Yeah,
that pops
I have
up.
the list. All right. So the first one we get is about Huckleberry Finn.
This is my favorite one.
He has retired. So Foy Cheshire says, "I also improved Jim's diction, rejiggered the plot line a bit, and retitled the book, The Pejorative Free Adventures and Intellectual and Spiritual Journeys of African American Jim and His Young Protege, White Brother Huckleberry Finn, as they go in search of the lost black family unit."
But then that one is followed by the great Blaxby.
We also have, yes,
Which does not, it just shoehorns black
which
into the
just
name.
shorts black into the name. The Dope Man Cometh, The Point Guard in the Rye, and Uncle Tom's Condo. I have more. The Old Black Man in the Inflatable Winnie the Pooh Swimming Pool, Measured Expectations, Middle March,
That
Middle
one's
of April.
Measured Expectations is really funny.
I'll have your money, I swear. And Tom Sawyer.
Tom Sawyer is the last one we get, which is in the scene.
Tom Sawyer should be described a little bit. On the cover of Tom Sawyer, a preppy black boy wearing penny loafers and argyle socks, exposed by a pair of flooding whale print lime green pants, and armed with a bucket of whitewash, stood bravely in front of a wall splashed in gang graffiti while a pack of ragamuffin hoodlums looked on menacingly.
The whale print pants are such a wonderful touch in that description.
And yes, and to go back, Measured Expectations, I think, is my favorite after The Great Blaxby, which, yes, to your point, is it just shoehorns black into the middle of the title.
Well, Hominy insists on so a guy who lives in Dickens in the neighborhood is named Hominy Jenkins, and Hominy was a former little rascal. He was Buckwheat's understudy, and he was in. We get references over and over again to all of the incredibly racist and what all the incredibly racist ways that black characters were used in media in the past, and in particular, we cite Our Gang, and Buckwheat's character and Hominy's character within that show. Bon Bon ends up with Hominy as a slave because Hominy insists on becoming his slave because he misses old school racism. And he seems to miss it partially because when he experienced it, he was famous and he's not famous anymore, right?
I think that's part of it. I think that it's partly that he was treated as such as, he was treated as a stereotype. And it's like, as we are trying to move away from that, where it's like, now we can look at that and be like, well, that's really racist. The ways that black characters were depicted on TV during that time were really racist. He was fed into that, right? He was treated as a stereotype. He was given these stereotypical roles, and he did them very well, and that's what made him famous. And so, yes, now again, they keep referring to this like post-racial America, and it's
We're erasing Hominy.
we're erasing Hominy, we're taking something away from him. And the New York Times review had something kind of interesting about that. That I took note of about Hominy, because we see him like, so as a slave, we see him, he acts as like a human footstool for Bon Bon, like he gets down on all fours. He dresses as a lawn jockey and goes out and stands on the lawn, holding like a gas lantern.
He will do absolutely no
And he
actual
does no,
work,
yes,
we should point out.
he does no
And we
work.
should
He's not
also,
helpful.
I feel like I want to defend Bon Bon. Bon Bon also points out that he tries to free him several times. Like he tries to trick him into it. He demands that he be free. And what is it? Hominy at one point comes back and says that part of having freedom of choice is the freedom to be a slave. Like Hominy refuses his
He
freedom.
does. And so something that the New York Times, something that was noted in the New York Times regarding Hominy said that after enduring so much racism and mistreatment, it would seem why not make it literal? And that is also maybe some of the impetus behind Hominy's choices and his desires in this book.
When Bon Bon is trying to free him, he says that simply telling him that he was free had no effect. He tried to ditch him one time in the San Bernardino Mountains, and he just to leave him there. And he had his lawyer, Hampton Fisk, I'm going to quote, "draw up some manumission papers written in industrial age jargon, and I paid some scrivener $200 to write out a contract on antique parchment paper that I found at a Beverly Hills stationery store because apparently rich people still have a use for it. What for? Who knows? Maybe with the state of the banking system, they've gone back to the treasure map." I just like that line. I think
I
it's
thought that
funny.
was a good line too.
Which is, again, I think a thing that complicates this novel. It is very funny.
Yes.
Like it had me laughing all the way through it, and it's turns of phrases like that that just catch you off guard, where like you're following something that is a plot point, and then you just get from this detail of the parchment paper where he's trying to this already absurd premise that he's trying to free this guy who insists on being his slave, which in a sort of weird way, I guess, puts Bon Bon and Hominy's servitude to an extent, because Bon Bon has to go along with this. I don't know, maybe.
I mean, it does almost because he's going out of his way to do all of these things for Bon Bon is going out of his way to like do all of these things for Hominy, right? Like
Because
he
Hominy's place was a source of was a source of solace for him when he was a child, and it's where he first met Marpessa, right?
yes, and so he feels that he owes Hominy something, but you know he. Hominy wants to be whipped and beaten, and so he starts paying dominatrixes
Yes, which is also
to
very
do it
funny,
for
is
him, which is
it
also
because
hilarious because he
and
can't
because
bring himself
Hominy,
to do it.
he can't bring himself to do it, and it gets very expensive because Hominy insists on being degraded with racial pejoratives, and all of the women charge extra for that because they don't want to do it.
Yes,
Like they,
which.
because it's a, like an extra
Which is
thing
again
because
like
they
this
don't.
interesting thing because their job is to be, de you know, their job is to be de is to be to get degrading, right? Like the part of a dominatrix is to degrade the people that are coming in, and to tell them that they're worthless and they're worthless and that kind of thing. And then yeah, like this goes beyond the pale of like what they feel comfortable doing when they're doing what from an outside perspective, you know, seems pretty extreme. Already. And then yes, they're
So
like,
in
well, we're gonna need to be paid extra if you're expecting us to go like antebellum with this.
and so what plot we have comes from, because it is not a super, it's a pretty lightly plotted book. It's more literary fiction than the genre fiction. But our main character has a sociologist father who is bizarrely and like terribly abusive to him as a child.
Correct.
He forces him to live out what
Piaget's cognitive development is what he uses to raise Bon Bon.
It's like famous sociological experiments, but he has also taken, he has twisted them to represent or metaphorically bring in something about the Black experience in America on top of that, including like Milgram's experiments. And he's the kid's getting sh electroshocked. He's being forced to live in a pig pen with a pig. He has his left hand. I'm sorry, his right hand tied behind his back so he can't use it to force him to be left-handed. And his father also just beats the shit out of him when
Correct.
he gets upset, and then goes back to the DSM and claims that he's having.
So he's using and to talk about the DSM for a minute, he's using the original. And for anyone who doesn't know what the DSM is, it is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. Pop it up, pull it up for me.
We have the internet.
We have the internet.
Diagnostic, you tell me what you thought it was.
Diagnostic and Statistical Manual
The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental
of Mental.
Disorders. You
Yeah,
have
okay.
it.
I thought so. Then the S was throwing me off. Okay, yeah. So the Diagnostic and Statistical Manuals of Mental Disorders, the original DSM. We
Yes.
are now at the DSM-5, and the DSM, I don't want to say that it's widely discredited because that's inaccurate, that's not correct, but there is in the psychological field, we are questioning the use of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders because they are not quite maybe as cut and dry as the book would have you to believe, or people use that it's maybe overused for diagnosis. So to be going back and using the original DSM is sort of particularly egregious. And he says in there like homosexuality is included in the original DSM as a mental disorder, right? So I mean that in itself I think is problematic.
Well, and think of the things that like you didn't know, or I'm sorry, that science didn't know back in the day, where like we know now that people do in fact sometimes hallucinate or have psychological episodes that are completely outside of their control. And back in the day, it was, you got to drill a hole in their head to let the crazy spirits out or whatever. Science marches forward, and the original DSM is out of date. We're on five now. No, he uses it both to diagnose him and he uses it to justify beating his son, when he says that he says he has dissociative reactions and he blacks out. It's not his fault.
Yes, that he
There's a thing
enters
where
like
he's
a
like,
fugue
so
state essentially.
yes, he's like, so for example, when I dislocated your jaw, and that line trails off in the book, but our narrator is a badly damaged young man who has been physically and mentally abused by his father, who raised him alone.
Correct.
No mother.
And something else that, Something else, so the Piaget cognitive development, something that is interesting about that is it starts from birth, and there are different cognitive developmental stages, starting with the sensory motor stage, as a baby. But it cuts, but it stops, like the his theory stops around like age 17, like in high school, which is interesting because we do not stop cognitively developing at the age of 17, right? I mean, you could argue that we continue to develop cognitively throughout our lifespan, and then certainly for some people, when we have like dementias and things like that, that our cognitive development might change or start to move in sort of the opposite direction and deteriorate.
We also stop and start. I was 17 till I was 25.
Yes, 100%, right? Like our cognitive development is a subjective experience throughout our entire lifetime. So it is also sort of a, so there is well, many things about the Piaget cognitive development are an interesting look at development and how we develop physically and mentally. It is something that people point out of like, but we don't stop cognitively developing at 17 and 18. I mean, we continue on again throughout the majority of our lives until, again, maybe if you live long enough, it does start to trail back a bit in the opposite direction. But I did also just say, I find that as an interesting thing, that that's what he, kind of used to raise his son. So it's like, well, when did he feel his education stopped?
He raises him also on a farm in the middle of LA. So the neighborhood Dickens where they live was started as a farming community in the middle of this like urban city environment. So he raised him as a farmer while performing all these sociological experiments on him. And then he is shot by the police. And he, let's see, our main character gets a $2 million settlement from that wrongful death, where he's able to finally buy the family farm, which he then kind of just uses as subsistence farming. And he makes a little bit of money that he doesn't need selling milk to the school children before they go to school and selling watermelons and other fruit that he is raising with all kinds of like sort of crazy hybridization, I think, to make them like the best tasting fruits available. Like his watermelon is famous. His, what is it? The Satsuma oranges
The Satsuma
are,
oranges.
those are the ones that like change people's lives. Like everyone's talking about his fruit, and his different vegetables and stuff. And then Hominy decides he wants to be his slave, which gives us the, for Hominy's birthday, he puts up the whites only stickers on his ex-girlfriend Marpessa's city bus as a present to Hominy, so that Hominy can experience some old school racism.
However,
And however, it turns out that Marpessa's bus becomes the most peaceful, polite bus in LA. And Charisma, the assistant principal at the local middle school, tells him about this. And then they start talking about, like, well, could you segregate the school? Maybe it would make the students do better. And we get this idea that is sort of central to the novel, I think, which is at first he's doing it just to kind of make Hominy happy and a little bit to thumb his nose at like what is expected of him as a black man from black culture, I think. Right? Like the Foy Cheshires of the world who want to like take white books and blackify them and like consider that like enough. He doesn't like that. He finds it regressive. He finds it regressive and unpalatable. And he also just doesn't like that he's expected to go along with it because that's what they say. And like it seems like he's doing it a little bit to be a punk. And then he comes to the conclusion.
So while you're looking for that, I do have the quote pulled up where Charisma and is discussing with Bonbon, what's going on with Marpessa's bus because the sign, the segregation sign, has been left up. And she says, "It's the signs. People grouse at first, but the racism takes them back, makes them humble, makes them realize how far we've come, and more important, how far we have to go. On that bus, it's like the specter of segregation has brought Dickens together."
How far we've come and how far we have to go, having the like the false idea of a post-racial society taken away from their eyes so they can realize like, nah, everything's still kind of segregated and we like need to like grind to like to get over on these people and to win, right?
Yes, and something that I think, something that's kind of again, when we talk about this, like nihilistic humor, so something that's a little bit funny in a nihilistic sense is that he has to pay a white person to get on. He has to hire Laura Jane. He has to hire an actor to come onto the bus and ask Hominy to move because the bus is such that it is in a neighborhood that it is not really transporting white people around. It's not in a neighborhood where somebody white is going to get on the bus. Furthermore, so they do make a comment. A woman with dreadlocks and a yoga mat gets onto the bus and talks to Hominy, and she is outraged by the sign. It does not necessarily imply whether or not she is white. I kind of assumed she was. I kind of assumed that like a dreadlocked woman carrying a yoga mat meant that she was white, and she was like kind of the one white person they get on the bus. And that then, of course, her reaction is to be outraged and to think that this is like an upsetting thing. So he has to pay somebody to come on and sort of A, again, because just there's not enough white people on the bus, and B, because a white person is gonna get on and be like, "That's racist.
The
Segregation's
only
over," because that is
I like
probably how we want to look at it.
speaking of charisma, she loses a math teacher from Teach for America that day because he gets on the bus and one of the little girls tries to give him her, it's a white teacher, tries to give him her seat and he takes it and then he falls to pieces realizing what he's done.
Yes. And she says about him, Bonbon says, What about that crybaby teacher? Mr. Edmonds is a good math specialist, but obviously he can't teach the kids anything about themselves, so fuck him.
Yeah. Speaking of the white people on the bus, I do want to throw this one out there. So when we first see Marpessa and Bonbon together as older individuals, not as children, watching the little rascals at Hominy's house, when we see them now that Marpessa had gone off with DJ Panache, they've broken up. Bonbon's trying to get her back always, apparently, because he is a borderline problematic stalker, it actually sounds
It does
like,
sound like that. Yeah.
by his own admission. But another thing that appealed to me very much about this book is the Bon Bon is a surfer. I surf. That was another like in the pro column. But he's on the bus going surfing with his surfboard, and he makes the comment about one of those things. I won't read the whole thing, but he talks about how in LA, like the bus is just you're a down and out loser, which is a very, I've heard that before. I've read it elsewhere. I've seen it in
I've
movies.
seen
I've heard
that.
people from like
Yeah.
LA talk about it. It's a very LA thing.
Public
Like you and
transportation
I,
is very different in LA. You know, we
yeah.
have both spent significant years living in New York, where public transportation is the way the majority of people get around. And like, it is sometimes faster to get
The
on this.
mayor takes public transportation like
Well,
it's
I mean,
a like everyone.
it could be faster to get on the subway than to have your driver in a town car drive you downtown because of
Oh
traffic,
yeah.
right? So it's like, you know, but LA does not have that with public transportation. And yes, yeah, so there does seem to be this LA implication that if you were on public transportation in any capacity, yes, that you're a down and out loser. And it should be pointed out that Bon Bon's mode of transportation, aside from the bus to go surfing, is a horse.
Yes, it's a horse. And occasionally he takes the pickup truck out.
Oh, yes. Yeah, he does. I guess he does have the truck. Yeah.
But as he's telling us about the bus, and he does the like the breakdown of like walking is akin to begging in the street, taxi cabs are for foreigners and prostitutes, bicycles, skateboards, rollerblades are for health nuts and kids, people with nowhere to go. All cars from the luxury import to the classified ad jalopy are status symbols. Because no matter how shoddy the upholstery, how bouncy the ride, how fucked up the paint job, the car, any car is better than riding the bus. But then he mentions that I can spot an LA newcomer a mile away. They're the ones who board the bus smiling and greeting the other passengers because they believe, despite all evidence to the contrary, that having to take mass transportation is only a temporary setback. They're the ones sitting under the safe sex ads, looking up quizzically from their Bret Easton Ellis novels, trying to figure out why the assholes surrounding them aren't all white and opulent like the assholes in the book. Which I like for several reasons, both because you and I
Because we
talk about Bret Easton Ellis a lot on this
pick on him a lot on
podcast.
this podcast. We're going to have to do less than zero and say some nice things about him.
It also points out, though, the like I like a literary reference anyway, but I like the reference to difference. He's pointing out that they're looking for a different LA. Bret Easton Ellis's LA is not the LA that the characters from this book inhabit, which is, I would argue, probably a more realistic LA for the majority of the citizens of the town.
Yes, it's not the rich, because a lot of times I think if you're not from California, if you're not from LA, I think that you look at LA as we look at it as Hollywood, and
Yeah.
for a long time, and I do think that the pendulum seems to be swing. I mean, we were just talking about segregation in media, right? And how we
Yeah.
have white shows, we have black shows. We certainly have more white shows though.
Oh, 100%.
And now I think with streaming, I think because more idea like I think more ideas get made. I think we are having harder and better talks about racism. And we have shows that have more representation of a lot of races, right? And we do have things that I think are coming together a little bit more, is not being specifically white, specifically a black show, but just being like, what if we had, you know, people with of multiple races all in the same show, and the show was about lots of people's experiences. However, I do think that an outlook of LA, and this book takes place a little bit more modern. Like anytime we're going back in time, it's to him. It's like the 90s where he's like growing up.
Yeah.
But I do think that 90s view of LA is white, rich Hollywood. It's Saved by the Bell.
Yeah. For what it's worth, I also think that we're seeing more representation in television movies because we broke the machine of how television and movies get made. Not you and I, we didn't have anything to do with it, but like the internet and streaming, like a downstream effect of like the ubiquity of these two things is that we broke like the system of like getting something in syndication on like NBC or whatever it is, or getting something on NBC or whatever that like you're trying to like prep for syndication later on to get all those residuals got broken a little bit.
Yeah. And also, I
But
mean, because, and I think also there's that choice of like, and then there's
I
that
bring that up
theory.
not to be disagreeable, but just to point out that like smashing systems is usually the best way to smashing systems works, I guess, is the
It does. And that I think is a principle in this book. That's something in this book, right? That he's smashing these systems. I mean, he's taking them back, right? I guess is more the way he's doing it. But I mean, he is trying to break these systems, and then we see in the book that it does that it is having this like positive effect.
Yes, to finish a thought that you started for us. So charisma gives him that sort of like the it tells him about like what like her take on why the bus is just like suddenly everyone likes it. And he thinks about that, and because he wants to segregate the school, she's asked him like whatever, and he starts going through it, and he says, "I'm not Rudolf Hess, P.W. Botha, Capitol Records, or present-day U.S. of A. Those motherfuckers segregate because they want to hold on to power. I'm a farmer. We segregate in an effort to give every tree, every plant, every poor Mexican, every poor black person, a chance for equal access to sunlight and water. We make sure every living organism has room to breathe." So he takes this idea of segregation and kind of twists it a little bit to be like maybe we'd like to just not be bothered by white people. Like maybe we'd just like to have a space of our own. I'm not quite sure what it looks like or what it means, but maybe just like maybe this can just be the black school and we'll feel more comfortable there because like we can just be in our own space. Although I guess it does go on to point out that the black school is majority Hispanic.
It does turn out to be, yes, and it does turn out to have a lot of Spanish people in it.
But he takes, but, and I think that's sort of one of the crux of like where the character changes in the novel, right? Like our main character in most novels needs to have a point where they turn a corner to some sort of realization or motivation or something like that. And I think that's it for Bon Bon, who, by the way, we mentioned that like he's called the sellout because Foy thinks he's a traitor to his race to some extent or not supportive of his race. Marpessa calls him Bon Bon because he's white on the inside.
Oh yeah.
It's also a mean name.
Oh, that
It's
is kind of
not.
yeah. I had forgotten that there was her, that was the reason she called him that. I had forgotten what the meaning behind it was, like what her take behind it was.
But he comes to take this thing that I think he starts doing as just like a just to be a punk to some extent, to just say no to the thing that has been served to him that he didn't necessarily come up with or have any say in. And he finds a meaning in it, which is to make sure every living organism has room to breathe, to make space for us, like is what it he ends up turning it to. Which I think is why this wild ass absurd premise of a novel works, is that turn that we
Yes.
get from the motivation for our character, I think is why this all hangs together and works in the end. Do you want to talk about what people liked and disliked about this book?
Yes.
What do you want to start with?
I want to talk about what people, let's, I want to start by talking about what people dislike about this. I think that's a really interesting, I'm very excited to learn what people don't like about this book.
Okay. So in this section, I go through Goodreads and I find the 1-star and the 5-star reviews. I do not generally quote any of the reviews. You can go read Goodreads reviews anytime you like if you feel like it. But I group together the most common denominators of the negative comments and the positive comments. So the 1-star reviews are generally that there is no plot, that it is very, very, very not funny, that they were told it was supposed to be funny and it's not funny. Too many pop culture references, which I take issue with that complaint. Difficult to read, including sentence structure and the general narration. The characters are one-dimensional, and this is a sort of amalgamation quote, but that it's never clear what the author is criticizing, if he's criticizing anything at all. It's never clear what he wishes to say, why he says it, why he wants to say it, or why he says it, and this is a direct quote, in such an annoying style of prose. Let's start with no plot.
Let's start with no plot.
I get it. It's you've got to be paying attention to like tease out the plot in this,
Yeah,
I think.
I don't think that it is plotless, but it does not I don't think that it is plotless, but it does not follow maybe the the
It does
blue.
not
It doesn't adhere to a
adhere to a
blueprint of
traditional.
what we think of when we read a novel that is fiction. It doesn't follow the blueprint, I think, of what we think of as a story, or the blueprint for the majority of what makes something, fiction, and kind of drives us along. So I think maybe we could say it has more of a loose plot. And I think you described it that way as we were talking about this in the beginning.
It is a very, it's not very plotted. And I gotta say, you could almost, I can see how somebody would forget when they get to the end and it turns out that Foy Cheshire was in fact also a buckwheat understudy on Little Rascals, and he had hidden and stolen all of Hominy Jenkins' lost old Rascals tapes to hide his own participation in this sort of minstrel show acting that was done back in the day. I can see how you could completely forget that was even a thing.
It's mentioned a few times throughout. Like, Hominy keeps being like, ask that guy if he's got my tapes. Like, Hominy keeps bringing it up. He knows Foy Cheshire has those tapes, and he knows
Yeah,
why.
they're not actually Hominy's. He just bought the last ones that existed. Hominy sold, he bought all the like racist ones that they were trying to hide. Like, I don't think they were actually Hominy's, right?
I don't think they belong to Hominy.
No.
He just wanted to have them, and he knows why Foy Cheshire is keeping them under wraps. But it's that Hominy feels that that's some of his best work.
Yes, it's his best work is the most racist work. That's why Hominy wants it back. But you can understand how, like, you get to that point and you're like, the fuck has been going on in this book? What the hell is this thing about? Like,
It's
that's how this ends?
yes, that's fair. And I think it depends too
Was
on
Foy
how you're
Cheshire
reading
the actual
this.
villain? Yes,
This is a
it
hard
does.
book to This would be a harder book to pick up and put down.
Well, and a lot of times you've mentioned this in when we talked about conversation with friends, a lot of times literary novels in general are not plotted the way a genre book would be. It's just they don't always really have a main. I mean, I can go anywhere from like Fight Club to Conversations with Friends to, I don't know, Song of Solomon. Like, none of them, there's not really a plot.
There's
Or, I
not
mean,
there's right no there's not always in
they're not
literary
heavily plotted.
fiction,
Yeah.
because when you have a heavy plot maybe has more clarity to it. It's a little more straightforward and cut and dry, like we talked about in Little Fires Everywhere. I think some of the things that she wanted to say in that book were very forthright. They were very there. We didn't have to like parse through it much to get that. Whereas literary works of literary fiction are just typically designed to make you think a little bit more. Like, I don't know that the author has, and I watched an interview with Paul Beatty, from I think it was PBS interview, like shortly after the book came out. I don't know that he knew specifically what he wanted to say with this book, was kind of the impression I got. It was like he had read something he had read proposing like something being called like segregated or like resegregated, and his kind of thought was like, oh, like kind of like wouldn't it be funny to have a story about a guy who tries to like resegregate America when it's obviously already so segregated. Like,
Yeah.
it starts loosely in his mind, and this again is according to the author.
It also diverges wildly from reality. Like, I wouldn't say that this book has magical realism in it because it's not quite that. But there are Thomas Pynchonian. I'm gonna assume that's a. I'm coining that if it's not a thing. But Thomas Pynchonian flights of fancy in this that are. Have you read much Thomas Pynchon? There's a point in one of those books where a character is looking for something in the toilet. And he just crawls all the way inside the toilet and then swims around in an undersea universe for a little while and then gets back out of the toilet. And then just
The book just keeps going as though that didn't happen.
the scene in Trainspotting is ripped from that, where that happens. But things like that happen in his books and it's not necessarily discussed. This has that, like, whereas one of the Care Bears talks to him.
I would,
Like,
yeah.
there's all sorts of wild like things like that laced throughout. I think what you just said though also addresses the it's never clear what Paul Beatty is criticizing or what he wants to say with this. I think first of all, I think it's a I don't think he does. And I personally, for me, I don't think that that is a responsibility of every creator, from whether it's an author or a director or a playwright, whatever it is. I don't think you have to underline an answer to something in a book.
No, I don't think so. I mean, no, I don't think so either. I think that.
Like, I want to go through and find out what it's a, like, I'll determine to some extent what it's about as the reader. Like,
Yes.
that's the deal we're making, is you wrote this, I'm buying it and reading it with my time. And to some extent, you can't tell me what it's about. Like, I'll decide what it's about because I'm the one who's going to spend however many hours going through it. This is one of those books that I'll actually say all the ones I referenced before, whether it's Conversations with Friends, Song of Solomon, Fight Club, all have that same thing. Like, it's the reader's going to imprint themselves on it. And I like that in a book. Like, I think that's part of the deal that author and reader make.
Yes, and you know, we talked when we were talking about sort of the like audacity of this book, as it were, and then it's like that I think part of that is that like as you as the reader have to figure out like what your reaction is, like how do you feel about this book? Does this book make you feel does it make you feel angry and offended? Like he has a great quote about being offended. Does it make you feel angry and offended? Well, like why? What is it about that makes you feel and you know, angry and offended, or you know, what do you think is funny about this book? Like, I think everyone who's reading it has to kind of figure out like what you feel about it and what you're getting out of it. And I think that, but I also, like I said, I think that's true of a lot of literary fiction. I mean, do we don't always read books to just be told something, or to just have our own ideology kind of spit right back in our face. I mean, sometimes we do, and that's fine. That's a valid reading experience. But again, like what I get out of this book as a white female living in America is going to be different than what like a Hispanic male living in California gets out of this book,
Yeah.
who lives in LA, right? So I mean, it's like, you know, whoever's reading this, whatever experiences you've had, whatever your race is, whatever your experience of racism is, like you're going to get something, or of pop or of politics, or of educate, you know, or of education. These are, you know, who how were you raised? And everyone's going to be getting something different out of it. So I don't, you know, again,
His
I
line
think that's a
on
beautiful part of literary fiction, but I think that's what separates literary fiction from being genre fiction.
Yeah, I think so as well. His quote, Bon Bon's quote on offense, on being offended, is, "It's not even an emotion. What does being offended say about how you feel? No great theater director ever said to an actor, 'Okay, this scene calls for some real emotion. Now go out there and give me lots of offendedness.'" And Marpessa comes back on him and says, "That's saying a lot coming from a callow farm boy who's never been offended in his life because his head's too high in the clouds." And he says, "That's because if I were ever offended, I wouldn't know what to do. If I'm sad, I cry. If I'm happy, I laugh. If I'm offended, what do I do? State in a clear and sober voice that I'm offended, then walk away in a huff so that I can write a letter to the mayor." If a murder mystery author doesn't like tell you who murders somebody at the end of the book, go get your $11.99 back. Like, that's kind of a that's a ripoff. You're a whodunit. You need to know who done it.
Yes.
But no author writing in this strain, I think, really owes an answer to the reader. I don't think that's what we expect from literary fiction. And I don't know. I think the point is for you to take what he's saying and decide, like, what you think about it. I think he's kind of written a snapshot of what he feels like. I don't know. It was a story of Black culture trying to find itself, and I think he's written it outside of the white gaze, if that makes sense. Like, this isn't a book about Black people trying to live with white people, or trying to live with, or anyone, I guess, any person of color trying to live with white people. Or, like, white people are not a reference point for the characters in here, I don't think, a lot.
No,
Do you?
no, I think this is more about, I think this is more about a Black experience, and I think that's the strength of the book. I don't think that racism always, I don't think that when we're talking about like I don't think when we're talking about race or politics, it always needs to be filtered through, like it doesn't always need to be filtered through like through white people and the white experience and like what we think and whether or not we think something's racist, when white people are often the perpetrators of racism as opposed to the ones that are experiencing it.
Yeah, I guess, like, this book exists. Like I said, I think there's just those two white characters in the book. They're kind of punchline characters. They're just background characters who are mostly there for a gag. right? Like they're not.
Yeah, and that's right. And I think that's and I think that we see the inverse of that in media so much that I appreciate that that's like a valid use of white characters in this book, in my opinion.
Yeah. Books that we've read, Valley of the Dolls. Honestly, conversations with friends.
It was also, yeah. No, these are
Although actually to I will say, having said that, I know nothing about the racial makeup of Ireland. Now that I'm thinking about it, I don't know that they a large black population in Ireland.
I couldn't tell you. Yeah, I don't know.
I couldn't tell. Valley of the Dolls.
Right.
Is an LA inverse of this book. Like they're black people are not even tertiary characters, I don't think, in that
No, they're
novel.
not. And the in our experience of LA and Valley of the Dolls is Hollywood specific.
Yeah. The criticism, too many pop culture references, annoys me because there are a lot of literary references in here. There's a lot of references to psychological and sociological work. There are pop culture references within this book, but I don't know that there's so many specifically pop culture references. Like, I guess it leans heavily on like knowing who the little rascals are, but that's pretty ubiquitous.
But that's kind of ubiquitous. And I mean, I think he picked that because it did come because it does represent it does represent a lot of racism in Hollywood, like during that time.
Like, I have so much stuff highlighted in here, but the quote that I read at the top, about California, the sort of like opening, or his sort of his ode to California. Right after that, he talks about talking when he takes over his dad's job of kind of talking down the like people who have snapped. He talks about taking that over, and one of the experiences a few blocks down the street from where I lived. Carl Kilo G. Garfield, hallucinating high on his own supply and Alfred Lloyd Tennyson's brooding lyricism, burst out of his garage, squinting into his moleskin, a smoldering crack pipe dangling from his lips. It was the height of the crack rock era. Whatever. This is his dad talking this guy down. But in that, we have the reference is to the crack epidemic of the 80s. To Alfred Lloyd Tennyson, because then later he starts reciting the rap that he's written called The Charge of the Light-Skinned Spade, which is a takeoff on
The
Tennyson's
Charge
The
of the
Charge of
Light
the Light
Brigade.
Brigade. Yeah. You don't have to like that in a book, but it's not a pop culture reference. Like, it's not Seth Rogen just talking about movies he saw 6 years ago over and over again in all of his films.
Right.
I don't know. I feel like it's a cheap criticism.
It is. I didn't I'm I don't know why somebody would be would I don't know why that would make somebody dislike the book. I do I
In the quote that we read about offendedness right before that quote, when he's talking about convincing Marpessa to turn the bus into a party bus, one of the things that he had to promise her was a first edition of Baldwin's Giovanni's Room. Like, the references in here are they're deep references. I don't know.
And they are deep. I agree with that. I also felt like they were deep references and not just like a bunch of sort of cheap, low-hanging fruit pop culture to make the book cool or something.
Yeah, and I like Seth Rogen movies, but like everything in it is like a Katy Perry reference or something about the Backstreet Boys. Like in 10 years, no one's going to understand. I think there's probably movies that he made 10 years ago that you probably would not understand now if you came at them because they are so chock full of media references from like the present. This doesn't do that.
Right, no, this is using things that are a bit more classic.
Like when he talks about how his father pitted him against the pig named Savoir Faire, never mind the fact that the pig is named Savoir Faire, but he goes through the Orwellian social order as a joke from Animal Farm. But he talks about him, it's him versus the pig, but he goes through the like, whatever goes upon two legs is the enemy, like the list from Animal Farm
Right.
of like how they decide like how they what they caste system the different animals. I think if you've got a high school education, you should be able to place most of these things.
Yes.
That's my two cents on that.
I do agree that the prose is a little difficult.
It is.
But I also
I
think that
gotta.
that's and again, just in the interview that I watched with Paul Beatty, he did he goes for like a sort of poetic style and a certain aesthetic. I mean, that was something that he commented on, and I did find it like, I mean, I would have to reread, like here and there, I would have to reread something of just like, am I, what's ha like, what's happening? What is he saying? Like, I did find it to be a, I found it to be a little bit wordy. And at times I did find that like the style and the prose was a little bit like laborious.
He also shifts randomly, and it can be hard to follow what exactly is happening. Like here, where he's talking about how all the children, he's explaining who Hominy is, the work that he did on the Little Rascals, and like how they would go over to his house when they were kids. And he says, when they found his house, Hominy would greet his devotees with a wide polydent smile and an arthritic finger wiggling high sign, inviting them in for high C fruit punch and, if they were lucky, slices of my watermelon. I doubt that he told his aging fan base the same stories he shared with us. It's hard to say what started the love affair between me and Marpessa Delissa Dawson. She's 3 years older than me, and I've known her all my life. That doesn't flow even remotely.
No, it doesn't.
We're hearing about Hominy. I doubt that he told his aging fan base the same stories he shared with us. What stories might those be? This sentence makes me wonder. But no, we just smash cut to, it's hard to say what started the love affair between me and Marpessa Delissa Dawson. Like it, nothing eases us into the introduction of that
No,
character.
when we come back to the stories of Hominy later, they're like scattered throughout the book a little bit.
And then this is kind of long. I'll read it. This is one sentence. He's talking about his father buying, he's talking about the farm that he was raised on that he bought after his father died. But as even the most cursory of those early annual inspections by the California Department of Food and Agriculture bore out, to call 205 Bernard Avenue, that 2-acre, just this side of lunar surface, fertile parcel of land in the most infamous ghetto in Los Angeles County, with its hollowed-out 1973 Winnebago chieftain motor home for a barn, a dilapidated, overcrowded Section 8 hen house topped by a weather vane so rusted in place that the Santa Ana winds, El Nino, and the 83 tornado couldn't move it, medfly-infested 2-tree lemon grove, 3 horses, 4 pigs, a 2-legged goat with shopping cart wheels for back hooves, 12 stray cats, 1 cow herd of livestock, and the ever-present cumulonimbus cloud of flies that circled the inflatable fishing pond of liquefied swamp gas and fermented rat shit that I pulled out of foreclosure on the very same day my dad decided to tell the undercover police officer, Edward Orozco, to move his piece of shit forward. Move his piece of shit Ford Crown Victoria and stop blocking the goddamn intersection with funds borrowed against what the courts would later determine to be a $2 million settlement for gross miscarriage of justice. To call that unsubsidized tract of inner city Afro-agrarian ineptitude a farm would be to push the limits of literality.
You ran out of breath three times
Period.
saying that.
Dude, like, his prose is difficult.
It's difficult. It's wordy.
Yeah, it's wordy.
Punctuation is
It
not
is.
always his friend.
No, it's convoluted sometimes. He doesn't always explain what's going on. I feel that one's a valid criticism. Like it's.
I felt that's a valid criticism. I also felt like it was a little.
I mean, I sort of enjoy things like that.
Do you think that the difficulty of the prose is a commentary on like, again, like this has come up a couple of times in our podcast because this is something that people say all the time that like, like racism is difficult to talk about. Do you think his like difficult prose is like you think it's difficult to talk about? I'll also make it difficult to read about.
I hope so. I hope he's gone that deep and he's just sort of like, I'll show you. This is a 75 word sentence
Because
or however many.
it feels purposeful.
A 200 word sentence. It does feel
It feels
purposeful.
purposeful. That 200-word sentence, like if I was editing this book, would have been like, bro, what are we
He's
doing?
also
Why? Like this needs to be broken up. This is a paragraph.
like he's a professor. Like he teaches writing. He teaches a course on like reading books set in LA. Like he knows what he's doing. Like everything in here is deliberate. This isn't he's not it's not like he's a bank it's not like he's a banker during the day and he cranked out a novel that was like just
No, the
happened to
difficulty
be
of the
comedic and
prose,
great.
it feels purposeful. He's done like There is thought behind this. It is not difficult because he wasn't sure how to get his point across. It's difficult for a reason. And I think, and my theory is that it's because, and I, because I want to say it's mentioned in this book. I mean, he mentions it in the article that, like, you know, again, just sort of that like hilarious comment people always like to make of like, oh, like racism is difficult to talk about. So I think for him, it's like, yeah, I am going to make it difficult. I'm going to make it difficult to read about.
It's going to be difficult to read
It'll be
about too,
difficult.
and Kennedy, screw you. It's going to be difficult for you to recommend a book about it.
Exactly. Yes. And you know, and so the difficulty of the writing, for what it's worth, it didn't take away. It didn't take away from the novel for me, but it did probably take me a little longer to read it than some other things that I could like breeze through. But like, do we need to breeze through a book about racism, or do we need to read it and take it in and reread things a couple times and really think about it?
Would you say it's a book about racism?
Do I think this is a book about racism? I do think that it is a book about that. Do I think that it's the only thing this book is about? No.
I guess that's what I was trying to get at. Yeah. This feels like a book about child abuse and the aftermath of child abuse. It feels like a book, even outside of that, about I don't know, trying to live up to your father, fathers and sons.
Yeah, so I actually made a note. I actually made a note about him because he does talk about. There's a quote. I have a quote for this. He says,
The rejection and acceptance of the way you are defined by your own family and
"Yes."
community feels like a theme of this book.
He says, "What little inspiration I have in life comes not from any sense of racial pride. It stems from the same age-old yearning that has produced great presidents and great pretenders, birthed captains of industry and captains of football, that Oedipal yen that makes men do all sorts of shit we'd rather not do, like try out for basketball and fist fight the kid next door, because in this family, we don't start shit, but we damn sure finish it. I speak only of that most basic of needs, the child's need to please the father." And so I did have a little note in here that I wonder if with some of this, you know, redrawing the border, back around Dickens, the bus segregation, the segregation in the school, is this like continuing his father's social experiments?
Yes, it's continuing his father's social experiments, and then he finds a way to put his own like idea of betterment for his community behind it, and like do it so they've got their own space
Which
versus,
is also character growth.
yeah.
Like you pointed out, that turn in the book for the character that we like see a little more behind like what he's doing, that I think is part of what makes this book good.
The prose, the people who like this book, funny is the number one, I think, common thing within all of the comments, is that it was really, really funny. Biting and acerbic gets used a lot.
I love the word acerbic, actually.
Yeah, satire gets used a lot as well.
That is how this book is summarized. That is how the internet summarizes this book. I want to say I read like three different reviews of this book. They all described it as a satire, and Paul Beatty in his interview did not describe it as a satire, that was not necessarily what he was doing, although he didn't argue the point of like, I guess you could, you know, it was kind of like, I guess you can call it that, but that wasn't necessarily his intention in writing it. Was not to sit down and be like, I'm going to write a hilarious dark comic satire. It was like not maybe what he had in mind.
I read several interviews with him where he called that out, that he's like, I don't really think of myself as a satirist. I think a little bit of that is him. The man obviously speaks for himself, but in one of the ones that I was reading, he kind of said like it's a little bit of just like self-preservation and the freedom to write what I want. Like I don't want to get pigeonholed as a satirist, like that's what I do.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair.
But I think it's really hard to write a book that starts the way this one does,
With the guy smoking
with,
weed on the steps of the Supreme Court.
yeah, getting Clarence Thomas mad at him, saying that Clarence Thomas like all people who believe in the system, he wants answers. He wants to believe that Shakespeare wrote all those books, that Lincoln fought the Civil War to free the slaves, and the United States fought World War II to rescue the Jews and keep the world safe for democracy, that Jesus and the double feature are coming back. But I'm no Panglossian American, which, first of all, Pangloss, reference to Candide. So again, get lost with all your pop culture reference complaints. Read a book. But it starts with this. We haven't even touched on this, but like the prologue, always my least favorite part of any book. The prologue in this just rips.
Oh, it's wild.
Like if he had just published the prologue, I still might be like, this was one of my top books of 2017, and it was only 20 pages. Like the opening is just tonally tells us what we're getting into. It's hilarious from start to finish, and all of that acerbic wit that everybody keeps mentioning in their Goodreads reviews, and the irreverence and the audacity, all of that is in there just from the opening line. This may be hard to believe coming from a black man, but I've never stolen anything, which is a hell of an opening
It is.
sentence. Then he rips through DC as a tourist and just has a bunch of great hot takes on that. Goes to the Supreme Court where he's just got a letter that he's scheduled for a hearing, which is very funny, I
Yeah.
think. And goes in and starts smoking weed, which he goes into such detail about, like wrapping the bowl on the mahogany table because it's cashed before he packs it again. I want to read part of it, but here, like just. Yesterday afternoon, like some sandal-shod Ethiop from the sticks of the darkest of the Los Angeles jungles, I ventured from the hotel and joined the Hajj of blue-jeaned yokels that paraded slowly and patriotically past the Empire's historic landmarks. I stared in awe at the Lincoln Memorial. If Honest Abe had come to life and somehow managed to lift his bony 23-foot, 4-inch frame from his throne, what would he say? What would he do? Would he break dance? Would he pitch pennies against the curbside? Would he read the paper and see that the union he saved was now a dysfunctional plutocracy, that the people he freed were now slaves to rhythm rap and predatory lending, and that today his skill set would be better suited to the basketball court than the White House? There he could catch the rock on the break, pull up for the bearded three-pointer, hold the pose, and talk shit as the ball popped the net. The great Emancipator. You can't stop him. You can only hope to contain him.
Amazing.
My, yeah, absolutely top tier all the way through to the final. Like, I don't laugh out loud at a lot of things, whether it's movies or TV shows or books, but I genuinely laughed out loud several times in this book. And that's the first one. The Great Emancipator. You can't stop him. You can only hope to contain him. Like, I want to get that tattooed on me somewhere. Do you want to do quotes? I might adjourn just because I've read, approximately a
I have,
thousand words of
so I
this
have a
novel.
couple, and they are about just like some of the legitimate, like more straightforward humor, in this novel. So I have a few that I'll read. And one more thing I want to bring into our thoughts.
Oh, we don't have to go straight to quotes. Do you have a thought you want to
No,
finish?
it goes with quotes.
Oh,
Yeah.
okay.
Okay. No. So I do have a couple quotes that I'd like to go over. And these were just things that stood out to me as just being straightforward jokes. So he's talking about his watermelons. He grows these really amazing square watermelons that he's known for in his town. The pyramidal shapes are big sellers also. And around Easter, I sell bunny rabbit shaped ones that I've genetically altered so that if you squint, the dark lines in the rind spell out Jesus saves. Those I can't even keep on the wagon. And I just again, that was yeah, like kind of like you said, that was just one of those things that made me chuckle.
It has some of that humor, like in Kurt Vonnegut novels, where it's just conceptually funny.
Yes.
Like just his hybridized watermelons that he's growing into shapes reminded me of the android that was perfect in every way, except it had halitosis, terrible halitosis.
Yes.
Like it's
Yeah, there
just.
is some Vonnegut-esque humor in this. And here's another one. Sometimes I wish Darth Vader had been my father. I'd have been better off. I wouldn't have a right hand, but I definitely wouldn't have the burden of being black and constantly having to decide when and if I gave a shit about it. Plus, I'm left-handed. And my final quote: Foy was no tree of knowledge. At most, he was a bush of opinion. And I want to start calling people bushes of opinion because I like that. That is an excellent as an
Yeah,
excellent slam for somebody. You're no
I
tree
want to
of
say
knowledge. At the most, you're a bush of opinion. And I want to start saying that to people when I think they're being Karens about something.
I want to unload that on somebody. That's a good one.
The last thing that I wanted to mention that I enjoyed in this book and thought was funny were the weed strain names, because he does. So he grows a
Yes.
small amount of weed on his farm. He doesn't want to be known for that. He always acts like he's gotten it from someplace else. He doesn't want to like feed into that stereotype. But the weed strain names, again, I have a list. Carpal tunnel, because after you smoke it, you can't make a fist. Code red, which was I think a Few Good Men reference. Ataxia, and ataxia is when you don't like have you don't have like great control over your gross motor movements. Prostopagnosia, which is when you don't recognize people's faces. And anglophobia, which is a hatred of or fear of the English, which is possibly my most favorite of all of them. That and carpal tunnel were the ones that made me laugh the most. But that's my list of all of the. I think that is the exhaustive list of the weed strain names. But feel free to write us if I missed some.
So, would you recommend it?
I would recommend it, and I think that I would recommend it instead of going by the plot that maybe it's just like an absolute wild ride and an audacious book.
I also would recommend it. This is my second read through. I liked it more the second time.
And our next book, you want to tell them what we're doing next?
I don't know what we're doing
Do you know
next.
what we're
What are we
doing
doing
next? Oh,
next?
Americana.
No. Oh, okay. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie.
Correct.
I am not entirely sure I pronounced that right. I think that might be the first time I've said her name aloud. But yeah, that's Americana is our next one. You can follow us now on Instagram at Reading Pop Classics. That's new, our Instagram page. You can also write to us at readingpopclassics@gmail.com. And please don't forget to like or subscribe or show positive affirmation of the show on whatever platform you listen to this podcast on.
Thank you all for
Thanks.
listening.
Yeah, thanks, and we'll see you next time. Bye.